Hey everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast. All right. Welcome, everyone, to Value Investing Live. I am pleased to introduce our guest this week, Sri Viswanathan, the founder of SVN Capital. For those of you out there in the audience, please feel free throughout the presentation today. Go ahead, post those questions and comments, everything like that. Let us know where you are coming from as well. We love to say hey to our international audience members out there. And we will, as per usual, be holding those questions until we get to the end of the presentation so that we can cruise through it nice and smooth. Without anything further from me, I will go ahead and hand things over to Sri today and we can jump into his presentation.
Thank you, Graham. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me and giving me an opportunity to present today. I've followed Guru Focus for a number of years and have seen many investment stalwarts talk. To be presenting on the same platform, it's truly an honor. So thank you. Over the next 30 to 40 minutes, I'll tell you a little bit about me, my fund, my investment philosophy and investment criteria, follow up with a couple of examples from my portfolio, and then open it up for Q&A. So here's a hello from my compliance team. A little bit about me. I'm originally from India, came here as a graduate student pursuing a master's in accounting. I then worked for an insurance company in Des Moines, Iowa. At this point, many of your audience members are probably thinking, accounting, Des Moines, Iowa, insurance. They probably are thinking watching grass grow would be slightly more interesting than this guy's career. I would tend to agree, but it has certainly helped me get to where I am today. I knew that I wanted to run my own fund in 2010 when Advisory Research, where I was working at that time, was acquired by Piper Jaffray. But I waited for another 8 years before I launched SVN Capital. Two very important lessons came out from my experience during those years. Number one, investing is an individual sport. And number two, the need for alignment of interest. I'll hit the alignment of interest in a couple of seconds. But in trying to answer what's the need for another investment fund in a sea of such investment funds, I came up with a couple of more questions. You know, what are the pain points I'm trying to address? And what's the likely source of such pain point? I realized that one such source of pain point is the lack of alignment of interest. In a market with more than 15,000 mutual funds, for example, more than 50% of those funds have no money invested in them from their portfolio managers. 90% of them have less than $1 million. I believe this lack of alignment of interest is one of the primary reasons for the bane of investing, turnover, transaction cost, and taxes. Average annual turnover of a portfolio is more than 100%. Thanks to high-frequency trading and other such strategies, the average holding period of a security in a fund is now less than 8 months. Less than 8 months. It used to be a little more than 4 years back in the 1940s. It's been constantly coming down. On average, a mutual fund holds about 100 securities in a portfolio. I think that's what led Peter Lynch to coin the term diversification. And on such high turnover and short holding period, they lead to transaction cost. Contrary to the beliefs of many, transaction cost is not free yet. It certainly is not in the international markets. You know, if you look at Robinhood's recent S1, you know, it shows that order flow revenue alone accounts for about 3/4 of its total revenue. So certainly, transaction cost is not free. And finally, taxes. You know, while tax efficiency is not the primary objective of my fund, high concentration and low turnover leads to tax-efficient compounding. And in addition to incurring transaction costs and taxes, strategy of high turnover and short holding period leads to disrupting the power of compounding unnecessarily. So here's a little bit about SVN Capital. I founded it in 2018 with separately managed accounts and launched the fund in 2020. It's a one-man investment committee. You know, more than 90% of my liquid net worth is invested alongside my investors in the same strategy. Concentration is high. You know, Joel Greenblatt, in his fantastic book, You Can Be a Stock Market Genius, he wrote that 8 stocks can give you 81% of the benefits of diversification. And you get 93% of the benefit of diversification with 16 stocks. I currently own 11, and I tend to own somewhere between 10 to 15 securities. You know, most funds take this diversification to an extreme to the detriment of the actual investor. The other point is I take a global approach to investing. You know, I look for investing in countries that follow either US GAAP, which is only United States, or IFRS. There are more than 110 countries that follow IFRS. But then I overlay a couple of other constraints. For example, I need them to be having IP and governance laws that are more comparable to the US. Companies that can file in English. And so it's a global approach, but with a very specific restraint applied to them. It's a long holding period strategy, which leads to low turnover. So high concentration and low turnover leads to tax-efficient compounding. Another distinct feature of my fund is the equitable fee structure. I charge no management fee, only performance fee with a high watermark, where I get paid if and only if I generate a return of more than 5%. So that's a little bit about the fund itself. And here are my investment criteria questions. Before I deploy capital into any one name, I look for affirmative answers for these 4 questions. Is it a business that I can understand? Is it a business with good quality operating performance? Is it run by honest, competent management team with skin in the game? And is it available at a reasonable valuation? Now, back to the first question, circle of competence. Now, for example, biotech, Bitcoin, pure oil and gas, these are areas that fall outside my circle. And so, at least as of now, I do avoid them. Second is the quality of the business question. And I tend to spend more time on the second question than the third question. So back to the second question about the quality. You know, in 2017, Dr. Hendrik Bessembinder, a professor from Arizona State University, he released a fascinating paper titled, Do Stocks Outperform Treasury Bills? You know, there are many interesting points from his study. You know, I'll let your audience, it's available publicly, I'll let your audience go into those details. But the most interesting part of it was, and I said 96% of all equities over the past 80 years have added nothing. In other words, only 4% of stocks have generated long-term gains. At SVN Capital, my quest is to find some of those that would fall under those 4% category. You know, in making some observations following such companies, at least 3 points jump out. Number one, value creation from a business is the product of return on incremental capital and reinvestment rate. There's a lot of different computations that go into it, but essentially, high return on capital and reinvestment generates, you know, value creation. Number two is the reversion to mean. You know, that is the constant in business. However, there are a few businesses that are able to defer such reversion. These businesses tend to be monopolies and oligopolies. Now, while competition is good for capitalism, it's not good for capitalists. And so the final point that I observed was, you know, over time, at least 3+ years, that value creation and price appreciation, they converge. So in the short term, multiples and valuation matter a lot. In the longer term, it's the qualitative features, competitive strength, culture within the organization, you know, those matter a lot more. So back to my list. The third question I ask is the management team, quality of the management team. Now, evaluating quality of the management team involves understanding the quality of the decision-making over time. Another aspect of this exercise is understanding the culture within the organization, admittedly a very difficult task. I generally find that owner-operated companies with skin in the game have a well-aligned compensation program and make good capital allocation decisions. Both examples that I have coming up soon are big on those two criteria. So finally, is it available at a reasonable valuation? That's the valuation question I ask. I tend to focus on free cash flow yield, about 200 to 300 basis points better than long-term risk-free rate is something that I look for as I look at valuation. So having said all that, you know, with that as the backdrop, my first of two examples is Evolution AB. This is a Swedish company based in Stockholm, Sweden. Years ago, I was invested in a land-based casino company called Tropicana Entertainment, a Carl Icahn-controlled casino, which was later acquired in 2018. And then later on, I was invested in an online gaming company called Amaya, which has now become the Stars Group in Toronto, Canada. So I've had some familiarity with the gaming industry, and with that, I started researching a company called NetEnt in Sweden. As I was going through the analysis in June of 2020, they announced that they were being acquired by this other Swedish company called Evolution Gaming. My interest in the company peaked. I did a lot of work over the ensuing few months, and it's now my largest position. So what does the company do? It works with online gaming companies to provide live casino games. You know, think about blackjack, roulette, baccarat, poker, all with a live dealer. It offers about 40 distinct games in addition to many slot games that have come in as a result of one of its recent acquisitions. It licenses these games to online casino operators, but takes the responsibility of running the games from either its own studios spread across the world or from the customer's casinos. Why is this company interesting? Well, a land-based casino can serve only a limited number of players at any one time, versus in an online setting, Evolution can support a limitless number of players at the same time. So the business is highly scalable. Not only does it not have the fixed costs of a brick and mortar casino, it can also defray its fixed costs over a large number of online players. This shows up in the fantastic financial returns it generates. Here's a look at some of the games the company offers. And as I said, they offer about 40 distinct games from 11 studios around the world. Earlier this month, they opened their third studio in the United States. It's a relatively new and young market for them, but they are the first ones to get going here. You know, even though the company was founded in 2006 and went public in 2016, the business model has become more robust as a result of following three factors. Number one, internet penetration and bandwidth capacity has increased tremendously over the last 5-6 years. Confidence in online payment solutions and mobile capacity has increased. And number three is increasing market regulations. So here's a look at the gambling market itself. You know, it's a large market, more than 300 billion in 300 billion euros in gross win. However, online casino is only about 5% of the global gaming market. While land-based gambling is growing at approximately 2% a year, online gambling is growing at 12%. And live casino is growing at approximately 32%. And Evolution is growing at approximately 50%. You know, unlike many other industries, regulation is actually a good thing to a large extent as far as gambling is concerned. You know, it brings a level of legitimacy. Of course, it allows the governments to take a portion of the winnings, but that legitimacy attracts more operators as well as more players. Given the state of budgets, both in the United States as well as across the world, it's more likely that governments will regulate more. Years ago, there was a bill in place called PASPA, Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, which banned sports gambling in the U.S., except in Nevada. In 2018, this ban was lifted. 16 states have now legalized sports gambling, and 5 states have actually legalized live casino. I expect more states to open up to both sports as well as live. Pretty exciting times. Another look at the market. Europe has been a little bit more advanced in this regard, advanced with its internet technology as well as regulations. And so today it's the biggest online casino market. However, both Asia and US are growing at breakneck speed. As I said, 5 states have already opened up. In the most recent call, the CEO talked about Evolution opening up its next casino in Connecticut. So there's more coming. And as far as the industry itself is concerned, some of the experts think that US can be 10 times as big as Europe over time. Here's a look at some of the operating and financial metrics. Look at that. Revenue CAGR over 5 years has been almost at 50%. Capital-light business model, average return on capital at 40%. Every single metric that you can look at, the company stands out. As I said, the company is doubling almost every 2 years or so. And most of it has been organic. Since going public in 2016, if you look at the tables on the right, revenue per studio, revenue per table, revenue per customer, all have continued to improve. And same story with EBITDA as well. The company is run by a fantastic management team with skin in the game. Founders are now on the board. One of the original backers, Ian Livingston, he owns another 7%. So approximately 18 to 20% is held by insiders. I recently read a book by Napoleon Hill titled How to Own Your Own Mind, which I would highly recommend for your listeners. This is the same Napoleon Hill who wrote the book Think and Grow Rich. But How to Own Your Mind is a book which is a collection of his discussions with Andrew Carnegie in 1908. In it, Andrew Carnegie says, wherever you find a prosperous business, you will come upon some individual who has creative vision. Now, let your audience read the book and come to a conclusion as to what and who the creative vision is. But in this company, I would say it's Todd Haushalter. He's the chief product officer. He's an American who moved to Europe, comes up with some very innovative products. As I said, they now have about 40 live games. And the lineup that's on schedule for the rest of the year is just as exciting. It's a great management team. Capital allocation has been fantastic. They've made a few acquisitions recently, which has bulked them up in slots and a few other areas. And so before I move on to the next name, a little bit about the valuation. You know, one of my closest friends with whom I discuss all things investing is Chris Mayer. This is the gentleman who wrote the book, 100 Baggers. I was discussing evolution with him recently, and he said, if I was rewriting the book, evolution would be at the top of my list in my book. When he finished the book, it was actually Franklin Resources, which had achieved 100x within 5 years. And he says evolution has achieved it even faster. So anyway, that's a little bit about the performance and all that. But when I think about valuation, I still think the stock is trading at a very attractive valuation with so much growth ahead of itself in both Asia and Europe, Asia and the U.S. And from a free cash flow yield standpoint, particularly looking out 5+ years, it's currently trading at about 5%. So that's about it on evolution. Let me tell you a little bit about my next name, which is Copart. Now, I call it the eBay of dinged and damaged vehicles. It's the largest auto salvage company in the U.S. It has a large marketplace where sellers, insurance companies, and several buyers who are dismantlers, rebuilders, exporters, and used car dealers, they all meet. You know, most insurance companies have an agreement with either Copart or its competitor, IAA. It's a network-based model with high barriers to entry, allowing the company to generate fantastic returns. It's an owner-operated business, and it's currently about $35 billion in market cap. Here's a quick overview of the auto ecosystem and the salvage industry. About 19 million units enter the system, enter the roads every year. About 13 million of them are removed, either because of age or accidents. 5 million of which are essentially salvageable units. And that number has been steadily going up. Back in the early 2000s, the management team of Copart, you know, figured out that the most effective sales process for their business is online auction. There are hundreds of sellers, essentially insurance companies, and more than 750,000 buyers from 180 countries that participate in these auctions. For that scale, yeah, their conclusion back in 2003 was absolutely perfect. The company currently conducts 100% of its auctions online. As a result, Copart's auctioning process was not affected during COVID. IAA, on the other hand, its primary competitor, was forced to switch to online auctioning. The robustness of a marketplace improves as more sellers come looking for more buyers and vice versa. In such increasing returns to scale markets, usually a small number of large companies dominate. As I said, here we have a duopoly with Copart and IAA being the two primary players. Copart currently has about 240 yards around the world in about 11 countries and is growing. Another important distinction in favor of Copart is very early on, the founder, Willis Johnson, he made a decision to actually own the land as opposed to leasing it. You know, in this day of NIMBYism, not in my backyard, this provides an added layer of barrier to entry. Copart currently owns about 8,000 acres of land around the world. And long-term key drivers. These key drivers continue to provide good growth tailwind. As the age of vehicles on the road increases and value of such vehicles decreases, they tend to get totaled more often. Average age of the vehicle is now approximately 12 years. Now, while frequency of accidents have continued to go down as a result of more safety technologies getting incorporated into these vehicles, the severity of accidents have remained high and actually continues to go up. In fact, during COVID, this was a profound stat. Even though miles traveled actually plummeted, particularly during the early stages, the number and severity of accidents went up because of distracted driving and overspeeding. And so the other point, the other long-term driver is repair costs. Repair costs continue to go up for two primary reasons. Now, new safety and other technologies get added to these newer vehicles, essentially making them computers on wheels. Now, for example, a Kia sedan now has a couple of cameras on its rear bumper, a feature that was not available even on a Mercedes-Benz 10 years ago. So repairing these computers on wheels is more expensive. And the other reason why costs are going up is because there's a consolidation going on in these independent repair shops. All that put together results in increasing total loss rate. Essentially, more insurance companies turning damaged and aged vehicles to these salvage yards. It currently stands at approximately 20%. And has actually gone up from about 4% in the 1980s. Jay Adair, the current CEO, thinks that it's going to continue to increase at the same pace over the next couple of decades, in spite of all the improvements that are coming. I referenced the creative visionary in my previous example. In this case, the creative visionary happens to be the CEO himself, Jay Adair. Here's a look at the growth and fantastic returns. You know, typically I like to look at a good long history of strong financial performance in my portfolio companies. It was Winston Churchill who said, the farther back you look, the farther forward you're likely to see. And so I look for good, healthy performance over a long stretch of time. When I look at that, you know, revenue CAGR of 11%, free cash flow CAGR of 18%, after-tax margins at 23%+. These are all fantastic numbers. Now, because of increasing returns to scale, Copart is able to grow its operating profits, margins, and generate very healthy returns. Not only does the company generate healthy returns on capital, but it also has plenty of opportunities for reinvestment, both domestically and internationally. A look at the management team. I think they have been fantastic capital allocators. Both the founder, Willis Johnson, and his son-in-law, Jay Adair, the current CEO, they own a big chunk of stock. Culture is an important aspect of my evaluation process, as I referenced early on. It is admittedly a very difficult one to evaluate, but a keen study of the long history of the company, management team, their annual letters, transcripts, proxies, and discussions with industry experts, they tend to give me or shed some light on the quality and culture of the company itself. In this case, for those interested in learning a little bit more about Copart, I would recommend this autobiography by the founder, Willis Johnson, titled Junk to Gold. Now, as you can see, this is an owner-operated entity. You know, they've made some fantastic decisions along the way. One thing I would like to highlight is, you know, back in 2008, when the great financial crisis was raging, Willis Johnson was still the CEO and Jay Adair was the president. They went to the board proposing a new compensation program. Cash salary of $1 and a million options each. Split adjusted stock price at that time was $7 a share. Stock today is about 145, by the way. Now, Willis Johnson has now stepped down. He's now the chairman and Jay Adair is the CEO. But he has continued on with the practice ever since. And in June 2020, the compensation committee approved the new program for Jay Adair, $1 in cash and a million options at an exercise price of $85. If the stock price closes above 191.34, and that, by the way, is about 35% better than where the stock is today. So, you know, before I finish up, a little bit about the valuation here. You know, Copart is actually one of the stocks that I added to the portfolio during March, April of 2020. As lockdowns became pervasive, the stock plunged about 50%, which gave me the opportunity. I'd followed the stock for a long time. We owned it at my previous place, Keeley Asset Management, where I worked before. And so at that price, I was picking up Copart at approximately 6% free cash flow yield. While the stock has almost doubled since then, I still think it is trading at an attractive valuation for the following reasons. You know, it's a duopoly with a dominant market share, high barriers to entry, mid 30% operating margin and improving. Value creation in the high teens to low 20% and an owner-operated entity. In closing, you know, I'll cite Thomas Phelps, who wrote 100 to 1 in the stock market. He said, to make money in stocks, you must have the vision to see them, courage to buy them, and patience to hold them. According to Phelps, patience is the rarest of the three. Graham, thank you for giving me an opportunity. I'll now open it up for questions.
All right. Well, thank you, Sri, so much for the wonderful presentation. We do have a couple of questions rolling in here, and I'm sure more will come in as we go ahead and jump into things. First question up, coming from Richard, saying he likes both Evolution and Copart. They're fabulous businesses. But based upon some of his calculations that he's been looking at, it seems they're a little bit they're overvalued at this point in time. So EV to EBIT being 91 for Evolution, 32 for Copart, with PEs being double 10-year median values. Do you have any thoughts there or want to justify one way or another?
Sure. As I said, I still stand by my statement. Both stocks are still attractively priced. Evolution. You know, before I talk about Evolution, look at all these technology companies that are announcing results yesterday, today. I mean, some of these are just mind-blowing growth. Google growing 60-some% in its advertising revenue. Apple growing 50% in its iPhone. These are really large companies that are putting up some significant growth. They are fantastic businesses on their own, of course, and so you know they're able to accomplish that. Bring it to Evolution. I think this is a monopoly business. You know, the closest operators in this space, there are a couple of them. One is a company called Playtech in UK, which offers live in addition to many other offerings, and there is an Asian company called Asia Gaming, which offers some of these similar products. But nobody really comes close to offering the kind of quality and putting up this kind of growth. Yes, on paper, on a last 12-month basis, most recent 12 months or even over the next 12 months, some of these numbers look a little bit on the frothy side of things. However, as I said up front, my objective is to own quality businesses over a long stretch of time. Given an opportunity, if the companies perform as expected, I would like to not sell them. And so if I take a fairly long-term view, if we think about Evolution and what they have done recently, they acquired this company called NetEnt, which is what I actually started looking at in the first place. Barely 1 month of NetEnt's number was included in the year 2020. And of course, they've had 6 months of performance included in the first half of this year. It's still very early days in terms of integrating NetEnt's slots. NetEnt is a company that was big in offering slots, online slots in the US. In addition to that, they acquired this company called Big Time Gaming, which provides some of the background strength for these online gaming companies. It's an Australian company. The management team continues to be involved with the combined Evolution Big Time Gaming operation. Fantastic growth ahead of them. So, this year the consensus growth number, for example, for Evolution is approximately 80% in revenue growth. I think, given the state of U.S. budgets, the state of many sovereign budgets, I think more countries and states are only going to open up. With Evolution being the first one in the U.S. offering its products, it's poised exceptionally well to continue to grow. And this growth I'm talking about is doubling almost every 2 years going forward. So, with that as the backdrop, I do think Evolution trades at a reasonable valuation. Copart, on a similar basis, it's a duopoly. The second best player is actually much bigger than some of the players in the online gaming space. But in spite of it, Copart has something that's very, very unique, a culture, a owner-operated culture with the ability to be very proactive with capital deployment, buying up land across the country, across the world, spending money on its technology prowess. And as I explained, the fact that they were able to come up with that compensation program, which is very unique, tells you a lot about the quality of that management team. Most times, as I said, in the short term, if I'm looking to buy and sell a stock, yes, those valuations will matter. But if I take a fairly long-term approach, 3, 5, 7 year approach, it's the qualitative feature that matter more. So from those viewpoints, both companies are trading at an attractive valuation.
Absolutely. And continuing on, we do have another question here from Mike joining us from England. And he is asking, what do you consider to be a reasonable free cash flow yield purchase price for a high quality company in this current environment where things are getting pretty pricey out there?
Yeah, I think it's a very valid question. I think about free cash flow yield more so than many other metrics. I look at everything, PE, EV to EBITDA. I look at all those metrics, but essentially, what's the value of a business, right? It's the discounted free cash flow over time infinity. And so I come back to free cash flow yield. And generally speaking, I'm looking for somewhere around 200 to 300 basis points spread over a long-term risk-free rate. At this point, 10-year Treasury, U.S. Treasury is trading at 125. Is it reasonable to expect that rate to continue to remain there or go up or go down? That takes me to a completely different set of arguments, which I don't want to go to, but that's what we're being offered. 10-year U.S. Treasury is at an all-time low of, not an all-time low, it's improved from 57 basis points, but still, languishing at the bottom portion of that range at 125 basis points. And to be able to pick up some of these quality businesses, particularly looking out 5-7 years, yielding you 5-7% free cash flow yield, I think is fantastic.
Absolutely.
And by the way, I do find more opportunities outside the U.S. Perhaps it's because of the valuation that Mike is referencing to, but I am finding more opportunities outside the U.S.
For sure. And another question rolled in here from Richard asking if you wouldn't mind explaining your DCF process, including that discount rate, maybe getting into a little bit of the nitty-gritty there. He's just curious there, and that would be if you like to use that moving out into the future.
Yeah, I mean, it's an involved question. It's an involved process. I'll have to share a whole bunch of details with respect to the actual Excel model that sits right in front of me. I'd be happy to answer that question offline. But generally speaking, what I'm looking for is history of performance that allows me to gain some confidence about my forecast. And using that forecast, I range somewhere around 9 to 10% discount rate, depending upon the business growth rate, looking out from, you know, somewhere around 3 to 5%. Depends on the business and not necessarily referencing it either to Evolution or to Copar. And so that's one of the exercises that I go through. That's not the primary, objective. My primary objective is to be able to think about the quality of the business and how comfortable can I get with respect to that forecast out into the out years. So that's where I spend a lot more time talking to other investors, experts, management teams, and competitors.
Definitely. And you mentioned just a second ago in our last question, hinting at some of these other countries that you're finding opportunities in. Is there any particular place outside of the U.S. that has really been standing out for you lately or has been offering up some great opportunities that people might want to go take a look at?
Sure. Actually, as I sit here, about 50% of the portfolio is outside the U.S., Evolution being one of them. Interestingly, over the last 18 months or so, I found a couple of interesting options in Poland. It's not a market that would jump out on the top of the list for many investors, but I think it's a fascinating country and some fantastic opportunities. In its history, it has not been independent for more than 50 years over the last 500 years. But since the early 80s, until COVID hit in 2020, the country had been growing at a steady pace of somewhere around 3 to 4%, had not had a recession in such a long period of time. And they've done a decent job of educating their citizenry. They've developed a fantastic tech talent pool. Gaming companies around the world have had a presence in Poland for a while now. Interestingly, Poland has they have control over their own currency. It's not part of the euro as a currency. And so the zloty has been holding up fairly steady over a long stretch of time. So that's one country that I would cite as jumping out and somewhat interesting. I'm currently working on a very interesting name in Poland.
Absolutely. Well, we'll look forward to potentially hearing about that in the future if we have you back on.
Absolutely.
Another one coming in here, and PK, please feel free to correct me on this if I'm not quite asking this right. But he was asking about some, you know, we do have all these crazy kind of explosion of these tech and very highly valued companies here in the U.S., you know, Apple, Facebook, the Amazons, all the big names out there that everybody knows. And he was asking if you have any insight into India specifically, if there's any correlation there with obviously some tech players starting to make moves there, anything you're seeing there on that front?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm currently not invested in India for technical reasons and for certain other reasons. But it's definitely a fascinating market. You know, we've seen a couple of new tech companies like Paytm and a few others go public. It's a wonderful opportunity for people who are able to participate in that. Is it related to the run-up in technology stocks here in the U.S. or in the West? I'm not sure. Standalone, I think some of those companies that are going public have fantastic future ahead of them. I think they are trading at whatever valuation they're trading at because of their own performance, not necessarily tied to what's happening here.
Definitely. And looks like Richard coming back in here and taking us to another part of the world, asking Chinese stocks like Alibaba and whatnot that for some are appearing quite undervalued, potentially Tencent as well in there. Any thoughts on if those would be a good play? Obviously, that brings in some of the problems, I guess we'll call them in short, that have been going on between the U.S. and China as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I do think over time, I'm not going to be able to avoid either China or India as far as my portfolio is concerned. I do think I'm going to have some fantastic opportunities popping up from those countries. I'm, you know, like your readers and followers, Alibaba, Tencent, and many other Chinese companies are trading at an attractive, very attractive valuation. We just saw a couple of days ago, many of these education companies plunged 50, 60, 70% in one day as a result of government's edict. I don't have a, you know, they are great businesses, fantastic free cash generating companies, great management teams and all that. I do have my own questions about governance. You know, for example, in China, people need to understand that it's when you buy the stock of Baba or Tencent, you're not necessarily buying the equity, you're buying an interest in a special interest entity out in Cayman. And so it's slightly different relative to owning, say, Copart or even Evolution for that matter. And so that raises certain questions, but they are fantastic businesses. I am seeing opportunities without necessarily stepping into those markets by going into markets like Poland or Sweden, even Israel for that matter. I'm not necessarily, by not investing directly in China or India for that matter, you know, I'm not necessarily avoiding them in my portfolio. Many of my portfolio companies have a presence, so I let the management teams of my portfolio companies take that risk and you know, get exposed to China or India through those. It's an indirect exposure, and that's what I'm comfortable with at this point. Over time, I do think both countries are going to be prominent features in my portfolio.
Absolutely. And on that note, a question that we do have come up here often for our guests that are kind of in a more global investment sphere, do you find it to be, I guess, more difficult or, I guess, lacking in information looking at these other countries? Or are you able to find that information in kind of different forms depending on where you're looking?
Yeah, it's a very important question, obviously. Trying to understand the business, the management team, and all that requires the companies to be filing in English. And so, as I said up front in describing SVN Capital, even though I'm global, I look for countries that follow IFRS, countries that have governance policies that are more comparable to the US and the West, and that are able to file in English. I don't want to be spending time translating those. But perhaps what you're asking is, am I able to access those companies on a global basis? And the answer is yes. I use Capital IQ. They're able to give me access to most countries around the world. And I run my entire portfolio through Interactive Brokers, which gives me access to 17 markets around the world.
Understood. And now that we've talked a lot about actually the companies at hand and potential markets around the world, things like that, when it comes to actually finding those investments, what's the process look like? We've had guests say that they spend the majority of their day, you know, reading financial documents to people running screens. What works for you for discovering companies?
Yeah, great question. So it's a combination of a number of things. You know, I also run a number of screens through Capital IQ. Read a lot, come across names and businesses through those periodicals, my conversations with other managers. You know, even though I'm a one-man investment committee, it is actually quite liberating. You know, my network has now become more global than when I used to be part of either Advisory or Keeley, two other firms that I worked for before. And so I'm able to have conversations with many of these really smart individuals from around the world. We share ideas a lot. And more importantly, at the end of the day, what happens is I try to keep an open mind. It's essentially serendipity that I want to hit, to come up with great ideas. It would be nice to have sort of a cranking machine where I could go crank and come up with some interesting ideas. But for example, Evolution, I was actually not looking at that company. I was looking at one of its competitors, and one thing led to another. And it happens only because I'm reading a lot about some of these businesses or talking to people who have an exposure to that company or to that business. And so over time, I sort of allow that serendipity to come to my help. But it's both a qualitative and quantitative search.
Absolutely. And it looks like we have another question coming in here from PK. Harder for you. First one here, I'm assuming is going to be a relatively short answer, but we'll go ahead and pose it anyway. So first part being, when looking across portfolio or one holding per se, are you expecting any minimum returns that you're seeing on those, or are you pretty, I guess, patient as far as that front goes?
So I have, my objective is to double my capital over a business cycle. At SVN Capital, that's my primary objective. What's a business cycle? It's typically 5 to 7 years. So if it's a 5-year business cycle within which I need to hit that objective of doubling, it translates to approximately 15% return per year. So from these individual companies, I'm expecting to do something better than that. Obviously, not in a linear fashion every year, but going in, that is my objective. Companies like Evolution, they're growing at some incredibly fast pace, and so I'll have those. Copart, on the other hand, is growing at a slower pace relative to Evolution, but I still like it. And so it comes to the matter of weighting them appropriately within a concentrated portfolio. But I think it's a good question. objective is to hit something better than 15% return.
Absolutely. And part two here from PK. Obviously, you said you run a relatively concentrated portfolio comparatively. We've had guests ranging in the, obviously 10 to 15 holdings, upwards of 50 plus. Is there any, maximum amount of holdings that you would say anybody should ever peek out at, or is it kind of dependent on the person there?
That's why I said investing is an individual sport. We've seen many of the stalwarts that have come and presented in your platform, Graham, range over those, 10 to 15 all the way into the hundreds. What I'm comfortable with at SVN Capital, I want this to be an one-man investment committee. I have a fantastic junior partner in the form of Willow Oak, which takes care of all the operational duties. But the portfolio management, I am the sole decision maker, and I would like it to be that way. With that as the backdrop, I would like to understand the businesses that I'm investing in fairly well. And if that's the objective, there's only a limited number of companies that I can realistically go after. I'm not only looking at the portfolio companies, which is now 11, but I'm also looking at newer opportunities. So in total, I'd say for me, I'm speaking from my standpoint alone, I'd say somewhere around 15 to 20 businesses is what I can realistically look at and be somewhat intelligent on.
For sure. And looks like one question coming in here from Mark asking, do you use derivatives in purchasing your stocks?
Yeah, this is a simple strategy that I run at SVN Capital. It's long only. I don't short. I don't use any derivatives. I don't even hedge my FX risks. So it's a simple long only buy and hold sort of a strategy. Easy to understand.
Absolutely. And one final question I'll go ahead and put out there, since we always hit a lot on buying companies, finding companies, things like that. You said with Copart and some of your other holdings, you'd like to hold them indefinitely, essentially. At what point in time do you actually find yourself selling shares for these companies?
Yeah, obviously, since I launched my fund, I have had to sell. I typically sell because it was a mistake to begin with, or industry dynamics have changed over the holding period, or finally, even though it's a quality name, I'm finding better opportunities with better metrics for which I need capital. I typically run my portfolio fully invested. By that I mean somewhere less than 5% cash I consider to be fully invested. Right now, it's slightly less than 1%. So I'm absolutely fully invested, which means if I'm looking for a new opportunity, I'm having to sell something. And it could be one of those three reasons. Hopefully, it's the last one, but I've had opportunities to do the other two as well.
Absolutely. Well, that is going to round out our questions today, Sri. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. It's been an absolute pleasure. Wonderful presentation. Lots of great insight there and some great questions coming in from our audience as I can see right now, as the thank yous are rolling in, they are very appreciative of you taking the time to answer.
Appreciate that, Graham. Thanks a lot. Thanks to you. Thanks to Guru Focus for giving me this opportunity.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of Value Investing Live. If you haven't joined one of our live streams before, check us out on YouTube and register for the events on gurufocus.com. If it's your first time hearing of us, click the link in the bio for a free 7-day trial of Guru Focus, where you can test out all of our great tools and features. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.